Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And This Week in Law is up next with me, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Scarlett Kim joining us from Privacy International. We're going to talk about how the Snowden mass surveillance revelations live on and the work that Privacy International is doing about that on the front of surveillance and government hacking. We'll talk about the iPhone 10 and Face ID, its privacy ramifications, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 406, recorded November 3rd, 2017, Ghosts in the Machines. Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Thank you so much for being with us this week. We've got an excellent panel of folks. We're going to focus on some privacy topics this week because we have a really fabulous guest with us, Scarlett Kim, who is a legal officer with Privacy International in London, UK. Great to see you, Scarlett.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, I'm going to have you tell us more about Privacy International, just in case there are listeners who are not familiar with your organization, but I want to introduce the rest of our panel first. Mike Keyes, who is a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, is with us. Hi, Mike.
Greetings from snowy Seattle.
I can't believe it's snowing there already. On the one hand, I'm really excited because I love snow, but you're probably maybe less excited.
Far less excited. But excited to be here with all of you today.
Yes. Glad you're inside and warm and joining us. Also with us is Emery Roan, who is a fellow at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. Great mesh with our show today, Emery. And also a fellow at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. Great to have you back.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to be here. It's the highlight of the week. And yeah, we've got an awesome guest on today to talk about some very exciting privacy stuff. So I'm excited. Let's dive into it.
Yeah, me too. Scarlett, so for any of our listeners or viewers who are not familiar with Privacy International, please tell us about your organization and the work it does.
Sure. So we're a London-based organization. We were founded in 1990, and we like to describe ourselves as a hybrid between a human rights organization and a digital rights organization. We consider ourselves a human rights organization because our work is grounded in international human rights law. So, for example, when we look at state surveillance, we kind of scrutinize state surveillance from the perspective of rights that are grounded in international human rights law. And most naturally, that means that we focus on the rights to privacy and also freedom of expression. But we also consider, for example, the rights implications for issues emerging at the intersection of privacy and technology. So, for example, if a state engages in a novel surveillance technique and then relies on that technique to gather evidence, for example, in a criminal context, we might consider how the requirement to disclose information about that technique might affect the integrity of evidence and the right to a fair trial. So that's just an example of kind of the range of rights we actually cover. And then we also consider ourselves a digital rights organization because we believe that the legal approach is sort of insufficient when tackling issues that do arise at the intersection of law and technology. So we have a team of technologists that work with us, and they often like to say that tech resides above, besides, and outside the law, which I'm not really sure what that means, but I translate it to mean that technology can be quite legally disruptive. And so one of the areas that we're constantly grappling with is sort of reassessing how the current legal framework applies to new technological developments.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's what we try and do here on this show every week is grapple with those issues. Can you tell us, since it sounds like it will help us understand what Privacy International is doing and the various topics we're going to discuss in just a minute here. For folks who aren't familiar with international human rights law and how privacy finds itself embodied in international human rights law. How exactly that works and how countries work with each other to have rules about privacy and other things that are above and beyond the laws in their own countries.
Right. So this is quite interesting as a topic to address in the U.S. context, because the U.S. is actually quite an outlier in its sort of lack of recognition of international human rights law in its own sort of legal system. But if you take Europe as an example, the international human rights system is made up not only of international human rights bodies at, for example, the UN level, but also regional human rights bodies. And often the decisions that come out of regional human rights bodies buttress some of the interpretations of human rights law coming out of the international human rights bodies, and they're sort of meant to harmonize with one another. So in Europe, for example, there's a very strong human rights framework that operates across Europe, and that's embodied in what's called the European Convention on Human Rights. And basically, there are 47 signatory states to the convention, which includes basically every European state, and it's actually a requirement to join the EU to also join the European Convention. And then each member state has actually directly implemented the European Convention into their own national legal framework. So in the United Kingdom, that's been implemented through the Human Rights Act. The Human Rights Act basically imports the rights that are enshrined in the convention into its own legal framework. And the European Convention on Human Rights, which in a way is mimicking, you know, the rights that are enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, explicitly recognizes a right to privacy.
Excellent.
How do they define that right to privacy?
Go ahead.
I think it's actually the right to private life is how it's described. And then there's also some language about a right to privacy in like correspondence, which is reflective, obviously, of the fact that it was drafted in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. One thing I found really interesting in prepping for the show today is that the UK, even though they have voted to exit the EU, would still need to resign as a member of the Council of Europe to not be subject to the European Convention on Human Rights that you've been describing. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And it's actually a point of confusion for a lot of Europeans and for British people as well. Leaving the EU does not mean leaving the Council of Europe. The UK would have to leave the Council of Europe to basically renege from the European Convention on Human Rights. And Theresa May actually did have initially as a platform issue potentially leaving the Council of Europe, but then withdrew that position when there was sort of a big major outcry domestically. And I think one of the reasons for that is actually the UK was one of the primary drafters of the European Convention. So there's a long history there in terms of the UK's involvement with that human rights system. One other thing to note is that the European Convention on Human Rights, one of the ways in which the rights are enforced is through the European Court of Human Rights. And European Court of Human Rights decisions are binding on states that are the subject of cases that are brought before it. It's something that's, I think, really jarring for Americans, the idea that a state would subject themselves to a court that sort of lies beyond its jurisdiction is very bizarre. But it's something that's considered quite natural in Europe, at least.
So I don't want to have the whole show as a lesson on EU civil procedure, even though I could definitely sit in for that. But can you unpack that a little bit more for our listeners? Because it does totally sound bizarre. Is that the rulings are binding because it's baked into the individual country's constitutions? Or is it binding because the court says it is and countries have just so far abided by it? Or how is it structurally binding?
So I don't know the exact answer, because I think that it might differ from state to state. So in the UK, I do believe that when you join the European Convention, you basically agree that when a case that involves you as a state, as a party to the dispute, is brought before the court, you basically pledge to implement the judgments of the court. But in the UK, for example, the European Convention wasn't considered directly applicable. And so they had to pass the Human Rights Act in order to actually implement the European Convention. This isn't exactly the case in every state. There are certain states, for example, that find directly applicable treaties to which they sign. But in the UK, they felt that they needed to have a separate domestic piece of legislation. And my understanding is that under the domestic piece of legislation, in order for the UK to actually implement an act of the court, it needs to be done again through another domestic piece of legislation. So the UK believes itself to be bound by the judgments of the European Court, but they're not directly applicable in the sense that it still requires another act of domestic legislation. Legislation before the judgment can actually be implemented, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Scarlett, these judgments that come from, for example, the European Court of Human Rights, these are judgments that would dictate how a member state needs to cooperate or act. These aren't courts that issue damages opinions or decisions. Is that right?
There is actually a remedy provision. And so depending on what the court determines are the scope of damages, it can award damages to an individual applicant. In the realm of privacy, the damages are, for example, not quite as tangible or as high as you would imagine, for example, in a situation of unlawful arrest or detention.
That makes sense. And we should just point out to our listeners and viewers that Scarlett is uniquely qualified. If you're in the U.S., we're in the U.S., to help us here understand the finer points of these issues of European jurisdiction and human rights law. Because Scarlett, did you grow up in the U.S.? I know you were educated here. You went to both Yale undergrad and law school.
I am an American, and I spent most of my life and part of my career actually in the U.S. And then I came to Europe about 4 years ago. I worked first at the International Criminal Court for 2 years, and then I ended up at Privacy International. So it's true actually that I spend a lot of my time sort of in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I try to translate ideas about European law to American audiences and vice versa.
Perfect.
Sometimes not very well to both audiences.
No, we're thrilled to have you. We desperately need your help. So we're going to dive right into some of the work that you've been doing with Privacy International on, guess what, privacy issues. We've talked a lot about Edward Snowden on the show over the years, and you know about the information that became public at his hands. What you might not know is there is some fairly monumental litigation going on in the UK concerning the mass surveillance the government mass surveillance that we know about through the Snowden disclosures. And Scarlett is working on this litigation. Tell us what's going on, Scarlett.
So I think for American audiences, they're quite familiar with two of the major programs under Section 702 FISA, PRISM and Upstream. But I think what American audiences are less familiar with is the fact that the UK, through the Snowden disclosures, it was revealed that the UK actually operates a substantively similar program to Upstream. So basically, the UK intercepts en masse all internet traffic that flows in and out of the fiber optic cables that land here, and also transit through the UK, which based on the UK's location is actually quite a bit of the world's internet traffic. I think somewhere between 10 and 20%. So we brought this case actually with nine other NGOs, including the ACLU in the US and Amnesty International and Liberty, which is kind of the largest civil liberties organization in the UK. Challenging basically the UK's version of Upstream and arguing that it's violative of the rights to privacy and freedom of expression as enshrined in the European Convention on Human Rights. And we also have another claim which has a US kind of angle to it. The Snowden disclosures revealed that There's a very closely integrated relationship between the signals intelligence agencies of the US and the UK, as well as with Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. It's called the Five Eyes Alliance. But the strongest relationship is bilaterally between the US and the UK. And what the Snowden disclosures revealed is that basically the NSA and the NSA's counterpart in the UK, GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters, basically have an agreement to exchange nearly unfettered access to raw signals intelligence. So for example, what we do know is that there are NSA analysts that are based in the UK that analyze the raw stream of signals intelligence collected as they're intercepted through the fiber optic cables. We also know that GCHQ, for example, has broad access to a lot of the metadata repositories that are managed by the NSA, which contain a lot of the material that they've collected through their own bulk surveillance. So one aspect of our case is challenging the UK's sort of direct surveillance through an upstream-like program. And then the other part of the case is challenging the UK's access to the US bulk surveillance.
So for people who, obviously the Snowden disclosures came out, what was it, 4 years ago now?
2013. Yeah, almost five yeah. years ago, four and a
almost
half years
five.
Ago.
Right. So for anyone who has forgotten, can you remind us what the difference between PRISM and Upstream is and what each of them do?
Sure. So PRISM and Upstream are both programs under Section 702 of FISA. And FISA, in the simplest terms, basically governs foreign surveillance intelligence that's conducted on U.S. soil. There's a separate legal regime that is called Executive Order 12333, which basically governs foreign intelligence surveillance that's conducted abroad, so not on U.S. soil. Section 702 is a particular part of FISA, which basically allows the ODNI basically to compel telecommunications providers to turn over certain communications and data. And PRISM basically is a program by which the NSA provides certain selectors, which are meant to be identifiers, to internet service providers. And the internet service providers then search their own servers for communications and data related to those selectors and turn them over to the NSA. Upstream is a program by which actually the NSA directly taps the telecommunications backbone with the cooperation of telecommunications companies in most cases. And they're kind of bulk collecting the internet traffic that's traveling over that backbone.
Great. Thank you for that, Primer. And tell us, we were sort of beginning to get into this at the top of the show, how Privacy International and the other nine organizations involved in this litigation are challenging these practices. What's the legal basis?
So it's interesting because the legal basis is not necessarily going to sound familiar to American legal audiences. Basically, under the international human rights framework and the European human rights framework, any interference with the right to privacy or freedom of expression needs to comply with what are called the principles of legality, necessity, and proportionality. And I'll focus on the principle of legality because it's a little bit foreign to a U.S. audience. The principle of legality essentially says that if you're going to interfere with privacy or freedom of expression, you need to have a clear basis in law. And that doesn't mean, for example, just a broad statutory authorization. It means that the law needs to be accessible and foreseeable. And it includes a number of various categories and also safeguards that need to be baked into the law. So those safeguards include laying out, for example, what are the offenses for which surveillance will be conducted? Who are the categories of people that are likely to be surveilled? What are the rules and procedures governing the retention and destruction of information and also the onward dissemination of any information collected? There are also a number of what the court calls sort of minimum safeguards that states need to comply with if they're going to conduct surveillance practice that interferes with the right to privacy or freedom of expression. And those safeguards include something, we call it individualized reasonable suspicion, which is not exactly the standard that we described in the US, but the idea is that you need to have sort of a factual nexus between the target of the surveillance and the information that you're seeking. The European Court of Human Rights has also recognized a requirement of notification to the target of surveillance, which actually doesn't exist in most European countries. And finally, prior judicial authorization, which shockingly, you don't really have in the form that we have in the US, even for certain domestic surveillance practices.
Right. So it sounds like a warrant requirement, but you're saying that in the US we have various provisions of law that where a warrant might not be technically necessary?
So one of the differences is in terms of the legality requirement, in the US, we don't really recognize this principle that if, for example, the government engages in a novel surveillance practice, that it needs to be sort of explicitly laid down in a piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. But the other difference is that actually, because the Constitution protects U.S. persons, you have actually quite strong protections for domestic surveillance practices targeting U.S. persons. So if you look at the Wiretap Act, for example, it's actually one of the strongest examples of a kind of robust surveillance regime. In Europe, the convention doesn't recognize the same distinction in the protections that are afforded to persons that reside in a member state versus persons that reside outside of the member state. So, for example, when the court is looking at interferences with privacy conducted by the intelligence agencies versus law enforcement agencies, it's actually articulating similar safeguards for both types of agencies because it recognizes a right to privacy that's more universal. And so what you actually have in Europe is kind of stronger protections in the foreign intelligence surveillance context vis-a-vis the US, but often much weaker standards in terms of domestic surveillance. So in the UK, as an example, even for domestic interception of communications, until very, very recently, there was no independent judicial authorization process. You basically had what would be the equivalent of the Attorney General signing off on warrants. There's also no notification requirement. And also, for example, in criminal cases, the use of intercept evidence is prohibited in those cases, which is often the avenue in the U.S. that we use to challenge unlawful surveillance practices, for example, through a motion to suppress.
I want to get back to the lawsuit in a minute, but you've mentioned the notification requirement a couple times, and I think that's fascinating. So the subject of the surveillance has to be notified?
Well, there's some dispute over exactly how stringent that requirement is. Our argument is that it's really a minimum safeguard, because if you don't notify targets of surveillance, it's basically impossible for them to seek a remedy in the instances that they believe that they've been unlawfully surveilled. And in the U.S. context, at least with domestic search and seizure warrants, and also with the Wiretap Act, you do have a notification requirement built in. But in many European countries, including in the UK, there's no notification requirement even for domestic surveillance practices.
Got it. Okay, so I think we've set the table. We know that this case is pending. Procedurally, where does it stand?
So we brought this case initially in the UK, and we had a series of judgments that were issued, and those judgments basically found that the bulk interception of internet traffic and also the UK access to US bulk surveillance were basically lawful in principle. There's nothing inherently unlawful about those programs. They were compliant with the rights to privacy and freedom of expression. The safeguards were adequate. So we have appealed that judgment up to the European Court of Human Rights. And we've now done the exchange of written submissions. And next Tuesday, there's going to be an oral hearing in the case, following which the court will issue judgment.
Thank you for that. Who do you get to argue? I know there are 10 organizations. Does each one of the organizations involved get to field someone, or is that restricted?
So the 10 organizations rely on a single, we actually have two barristers, British barristers, mm-hmm. who are going to be arguing on our behalf. And actually, our case was joined with two other cases, which brings the number of applicants before the court up to 16, 14 of which are organizations. So you can imagine the coordination process in determining who the legal representative would be and sort of what arguments.
Lots of conference calls, I'm sure.
Yes, too many conference calls.
Wonderful. Well, I can feel Emery burning with questions. So Emery, take it away.
No, to be honest, you've asked all the questions I've had so far. I'm just sitting back here listening to this lecture. I don't know. One of the things I wanted to throw out while I was doing research for this for the show today was I was reading the complaint Big Brother Watch and Others v. United Kingdom. For the case. And under the relevant domestic law, I had never read the Intelligence Services Act of 1994, which provides the statutory basis for the operation of the United Kingdom's Secret Intelligence Service. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, I'd love to hear your take on it, is, you know, we're probably going to be talking about Section 702 later and the ways that it may be exploited to allow sort of unnecessary amounts of domestic surveillance. But I thought it was interesting that the statutory basis for the UK's intelligence service seems really, really broad as well. I'm just going to read from here because I don't want to misquote it. Sure. But the functions of the intelligence service shall be exercisable only in these three circumstances: A, in the interests of national security with particular reference to the defense and foreign policies of Her Majesty's government in the United Kingdom; C, in support of the prevention of or detection of serious crime. And I'm jumping back to B here because this is the one that seems especially broad. Not that those two aren't also very broad, but B allows for the intelligence service to act in the interest of economic well-being of the United Kingdom, which just seems really broad, right?
It is.
I don't really have a good question for that, but that just sort of threw up light bulbs all over my head. You're telling me that the safeguards are basically limited to, I mean, the intelligence agencies can act purely based on economic interests for the UK?
And who gets to make that judgment?
So I think one of the things you've highlighted is one of the major differences that I mentioned between kind of the US and European legal frameworks, which is, so for example, in the UK, there isn't as clear a demarcation between the activities that are carried out by sort of what you would consider the intelligence agencies versus sort of the domestic agencies. And it's GCHQ and MI5, MI6, they all kind of share the responsibility of combating, for example, terrorism and protecting national security. And that can range from activities conducted on UK soil and abroad. And there isn't the same sort of distinction in the types of protections that are afforded UK persons and non-UK persons. There are more robust protections afforded to UK persons, but not exactly to the extent that they are afforded to the to US persons under the Constitution. Now, one thing to note is that it's true those purposes are very broad, and we would argue are overly broad. And in also in general, the definition of national security has broadened over the years as well to encompass a broad range of things. One thing to note is that the UK recently passed a new framework legislation governing surveillance. And in that legislation, there is a slight narrowing of the economic well-being purpose in that when the intelligence agencies conduct surveillance, they can do it for the purpose of safeguarding economic well-being, but there has to be a national, it needs to be related to, there needs to be a national security element that's kind of built into that as well.
Do we know of any examples when that justification has been used?
Not any specific examples, but I hesitate to kind of come up with harebrained examples. But one example that we might think of is potentially sort of in the Brexit context. So to the extent that the UK feels that in order to secure its position vis-a-vis its exit from the EU, there's both a kind of economic well-being argument, but there's also a lot of arguments about, for example, how when the UK exits the EU, how it's going to negotiate its position in terms of sharing information with relation to a criminal, you know, law enforcement and that sort of thing with the European institutions. So I think there's, you could imagine a scenario where the Brexit negotiations, although we think of them as largely a kind of economically focused set of negotiations, might also encompass issues related to the UK's interest in protecting its ability to forestall national security threats and that sort of thing. Mm. And perhaps there are surveillance objectives that could fall that could kind of straddle the two subject matter areas.
It just seems like it's asking for tensions among your other allied nations. It just seems very weird. Mm-hmm. I can't get over that.
Yes,
that Germany would be okay with sharing information, but the Five Eyes even. I mean, why would they? It's mind blowing.
Yeah. I mean, with the Five Eyes, it's interesting because the agreement prohibits the eyes, each of the eyes, from spying on the citizens of the other eyes. But the agreement was written in the 1950s, and we actually haven't seen it's been amended numerous times since, but the most recent publicly available version dates back to, I think, 1955 or 1956. And so I think there's this major question about how that kind of rule applies when you have kind of bulk surveillance capabilities and you're allowing the agencies to have nearly unfettered access to kind of the raw signals intelligence. How are you actually applying safeguards around whether or not they're accessing information related to the citizens of other countries in that context, whether just scooping up so much communications and data and allowing the agencies to be able to access that in really easy ways.
Right. Isn't the argument like it's spying if it's, you know, on a single targeted individual, but when we're scooping up everything, it's suddenly not spying.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I can actually sort of see the point there, but it doesn't mean that it can't become spying when the information's drilled down into. Scarlett, yeah. What happens after your argument? How long do you think it will be until you know the outcome?
Well, the court moves slowly,
no,
but I think
really?
we're
shocked. I've never heard of that before.
Very slowly. I think we would expect a judgment in 2018, but it's really hard to divine when exactly that would be. I mean, what's interesting is that next year will be sort of the fifth year anniversary of the Snowden disclosures. Mm-hmm. So we think actually the timing, I mean, we'd obviously have hoped for the litigation to have moved faster, but the timing is quite interesting in that it will overlap with that anniversary.
Yes, that is. And so, hopefully we'll have some sort of determination as we ponder the outcome of those disclosures 5 years later. Emery, you had another question?
Yeah, I just had one more thought, I guess, and we're not going to get an answer to this, I'm sure. But mm-hmm. Just like, I mean, we'll be talking about 702 later and its implications for data portability, the EU-US privacy shield and the GDPR. I mean, how do you think that your case has the potential to affect the that situation, the, I guess, currently untenable situation between EU and US companies trying to move data between each other?
Yeah, I mean, our case won't have as much of a direct impact because we're largely focusing on UK surveillance practices. But one thing to note is that this assessment of whether or not the US... So what the EU does is it issues these adequacy determinations. These adequacy determinations are for third countries outside of the EU to determine whether or not companies can transfer data over to those countries. What's really interesting is that the UK, in leaving the EU, will be subject to a very similar adequacy determination as the US. And I think some of the arguments that we're making about the surveillance framework in the UK will feed into the EU's determination about whether or not the UK data protection framework is adequate for transfers from companies based in the EU, data transfers from those companies over to the UK in much the same way that those issues are animating the discussions about data transfers from the EU to the US.
Yeah, I know we don't have this in the rundown, and we have lots else in the rundown that I want to get to, but as long as we're on the topic of important developments in the EU, UK, and the US, we discussed last week how the United States Supreme Court has decided to hear this case involving Microsoft and data held in its servers in Ireland. And whether Microsoft would be complied to respond to law enforcement requests here in the U.S. for that data that is abroad. Microsoft has objected, and it's made its way through the courts here in the U.S. I'm just wondering what your take on that is, and if there's a European and or U.K. pulse that can be taken as to the outcome of that case, what sure. the perspective is there.
So actually, European institutions are extremely interested in this case. And actually, before the Second Circuit, I believe there was a member of European Parliament and also Ireland that submitted an amicus briefs. And I believe before SCOTUS, there are likely to be EU institutions, perhaps the EU Commission, and potentially EU states as well, that will also submit amicus briefs. Generally, the position is that that Microsoft should prevail in this case because the U.S. sort of unilaterally trying to reach into Ireland and compel Microsoft to turn over that data kind of runs roughshod over the data protection framework that exists in the EU to protect that data. And the way in which the U.S. is meant to respect that framework is basically to comply with the MLAT process, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty process, which sets out the procedure by which the U.S. would request Ireland to turn over that data rather than unilaterally sort of forcing Microsoft to do it itself.
Got it. Thank you. Mike, anything you want to chime in on or ask about before we move on and talk about iPhones?
Yeah, just a couple of very quick procedural questions, Scarlett. So you had mentioned that your case that we were talking about a moment ago was initially pending before the UK courts. During that process, were you entitled to do like discovery, like what we would do in a typical US suit where you're asking for documents and disclosures and what have you?
Yeah. So what's really interesting is that in the UK, there's this specialized tribunal called the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, and they basically govern claims against the intelligence services and also claims challenging unlawful surveillance by other bodies as well. And the IPT, one of the outcomes of our case is that in bringing the case, we kind of forced the IPT to kind of develop certain procedures. I mean, up until the point that we brought our case, it had a few sort of individual small complaints that, individuals were bringing against, for example, a police force for potentially unlawfully retaining their data. And at that time, the IPT really didn't have a lot of well-developed procedures, for example, concerning discovery or what we describe as disclosure in the UK, or, for example, open hearings. For a long time, the IPT actually didn't allow open hearings and also allowed the governments to engage in a lot of presentation of evidence in closed hearings without ample disclosure to parties on the other side of the case. So in that case, we actually did receive quite a bit of disclosure, but the government successfully argued that there were certain materials that were too sensitive to reveal, and therefore they presented them sort of ex parte in these closed hearings. But in the course of the proceedings, we actually pushed and I think successfully got the IPT to kind of reform its procedures to some extent, requiring more disclosure than it has in the past and also requiring it to hold open hearings and issue its judgment in public as well. Because I think in the past there were cases where they issued kind of a short summary of their judgment, but not sort of a more publicly reasoned finding.
Interesting. And so once that case was ultimately decided by the UK courts, you'd mentioned that it was appealed to the European court. Is that something akin to like the Supreme Court here in the United States issuing a final decision and then a party appealing to the European court? Because that's kind of foreign to our concept, I think, of U.S. jurisprudence. You know, we think of the U.S. Yeah. Supreme Court being the highest court in the land, and that's it, regardless of what the dispute right. is. But it sounds like things are a little bit different.
So the Investigatory Powers Tribunal is really strange because there is this court, you know, there is a three-tiered court system, what we would consider what we call sort of the regular courts of general jurisdiction in the UK. And the IPT is a court of specialized jurisdiction. And the piece of statute that created it actually didn't create any domestic rights of appeal. So there is a court of appeal and there is a UK Supreme Court, but that piece of legislation basically said that there was no domestic route of appeal up from the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. So the European Court of Human Rights requires that you exhaust all domestic remedies. And if you were bringing, for example, a claim through the regular courts, you definitely have to progress that claim all the way up to the Supreme Court before you could then file an application before the European Court of Human Rights. But in this instance, because the IPT doesn't have any domestic routes of appeal, you can go directly from the IPT, the Investigatory Powers mm-hmm. Tribunal, over to the European Court. And there really isn't a very good analogy to the U.S. context, I mean, except for example, the extent that the U.S. is part of the Organization of American States, which has also a kind of regional human rights court system, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. But it's really not robust in the same way that the European Court of Human Rights is.
Interesting. Thank you.
I have a couple more questions as long as we're sticking on just for a little bit more. I know we're trying to move
sure.
on, but
no, that's okay.
A few more questions. One of them, Beatmaster in the chat, brought up a good point. He asked the question, or she asked the question, how rubber stampy are these courts? And I think the question sort of speaks for itself.
I mean, I think we would argue that that they're quite rubber stampy. Just to give an example of with this recent piece of litigation. So with our intelligence sharing claim, our argument was that basically in the UK, there's like no legal framework governing how the UK accesses US bulk surveillance. And over the course of the proceedings, the government basically claimed that they had what they call below the waterline rules, basically secret rules that they felt were too sensitive to disclose publicly, even though it's basically like the regulatory framework guiding how the UK government accesses this information. It's not like operational details. It's like, what are the safeguards and oversight governing this this type of access? And the Investigatory Powers Tribunal then bought this argument and also permitted the government to present in a closed hearing that we weren't allowed to attend those rules in secret. And then following that hearing, they turned over to us literally a 2-page Word document that kind of summarized what those rules were, but also refused to force the government to explain what that Word document was. Like, was it the actual policy or the summary of the policy or a summary of the arguments they made during the closed hearings? And they not only refused to force the government to clarify what this document was and whether or not it was actually the rules governing how the UK accesses foreign intelligence surveillance collected by other governments, but it argued that this was adequate as a legal framework. And I think it just kind of gives you some sense of how much is still kind of closed off to us in the proceedings and how much they're kind of accepting the government's arguments, not only with respect to the actual rules, but also the government's arguments about what should be actually made transparent, what the scope of transparency should be.
So I've got, I guess, 2 follow-up questions on that. You know, the first one is, I think that there's a lot of revisionist history out there about sort of what Ed Snowden revealed and people saying, oh, you know, he didn't tell us anything that we didn't already know. So maybe if you could, you know, how instrumental were the Snowden revelations in this case moving forward? And then the follow-up question to the previous question, I guess, is given how rubber stampy they are, how and I don't, I'm sure that, you know, there's a certain amount you can't share, but how optimistic or cynical should we be about the outcome of this?
So the Edward Snowden disclosures, at least in the UK, had an enormous impact because it revealed a wide-ranging number of practices that the public was just completely unaware of. This included the bulk interception of internet traffic. It included the ways in which the intelligence agencies were accessing foreign intelligence surveillance, which could include surveillance on UK persons. And it also relates to actually hacking capabilities, which is another case that we brought in the aftermath of the Snowden disclosures. So prior to the disclosures, we were completely in the dark in terms of the fact that intelligence agencies and actually other public bodies in the UK actually had these capabilities and were using them quite expansively, both domestically and abroad. So in many ways, the Snowden disclosures not only fueled this litigation, but really uncovered a lot of practices that people had no idea about. And I think one sort of neutral measure of that is the fact that following the Snowden disclosures, there were three major reviews that were undertaken in the UK of the UK surveillance practices. One was by the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament. One was by a person who's called the Independent Reviewer of Terrorism Legislation. He's kind of like an independent oversight expert, and his mandate is to oversee and report on terrorism related. Yes, a single person independent reviewer. And then there was a third review that was conducted by a think tank. And those three reviews then fed into a major debate within Parliament that resulted in the recent framework surveillance legislation that was passed, which I described. It was passed I think in December 2016. And even though, from our perspective, that surveillance legislation is a litany of horrors in the types of surveillance powers that they authorize, one of the outcomes of the Snowden disclosures is that these powers and these capabilities are now publicly known, and they're now have been placed on statutory footing. And then prior to the Snowden disclosures, the agencies were engaging in these powers, but entirely in secret.
And then are you able to give us a little bit of your own, I guess, opinions on how optimistic or cynical we should be about seeing governments voluntarily rolling back some of these, or voluntarily, I guess, complying with orders to roll back these?
I mean, I guess I'm quite cynical. I'm sort of cynical as a person, but I think it also comes from the fact that I work in the realm of privacy and surveillance.
Yeah.
I think transparency is kind of the low-hanging fruit, and there's still a lot of work to be done. There's still a lot that we don't know about how governments engage in especially novel surveillance practices. They're increasingly engaging in these practices without a clear legal basis or sometimes based on secret interpretations of law. But even when we are able to win on transparency grounds and force disclosure, I think it is enormously, enormously difficult to roll back these powers once the agencies have them. And we as organizations alone can't really win that fight. I mean, that fight actually resides more in the public sphere. And that's something that, you know, there's just a lot more work to be done, I think, to educate ordinary citizens about what these powers look like, the chilling effects that they can have. It's obviously just a lot more difficult because the rights to privacy and freedom of expression are more intangible. And I think there's a lot more work that we can do in general to kind of translate what violations of those rights, especially on a broad-ranging scale, kind of means, especially as we start to integrate more and more technology sort of into the fabric of our lives. And I don't know how successful we've been so far. It's a rather pessimistic take on things, but it's something that we definitely think about a lot.
The privacy advocacy world will do that to you, unfortunately.
Yes. All right. And that seems like a really good segue into talking about new technologies integrating into our life. Just today is the first day the iPhone X is shipping, complete with its new 3D facial recognition technology. We'll get to that in just a second. Before I lose track of the fact that I want to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in the show in case you are watching or listening, hoping to get MCLE credit in your jurisdiction if you're a lawyer, or professional credit in another field. We put these in so that you can demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show if you need to do that for your oversight body. Our first passphrase is going to be rubber stampy for this episode. So jot that down. We'll put another phrase into the show before we conclude. If you are a lawyer in the U.S. and need some information about applying to receive MCLE credit in your jurisdiction, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law show page there, and we've got a chart that will help you learn how you might apply in your jurisdiction. We are not here at TWIT or at This Week in Law an approved provider in any of the jurisdictions of the U.S., but we do know that there are listeners and viewers who take it upon themselves to submit an application and try and get credit. So we try and help them out however we can. So we'll put another phrase in before the end of the show. But right now, let's talk about Face ID, which hits the pockets of a lot of folks these days as the iPhone X begins shipping today. The Daily Mail in the UK wrote about many of the privacy concerns raised by Face ID, and we're going to talk about some of those right now. But it also wrote that Apple's introduction is likely to bring about widespread use of facial recognition technology in a way that we haven't seen before, even though facial recognition technology is in other things. This is going to make it a really ubiquitous kind of thing. It's going to inure people to biometrics in a way that they have not been used to before. And it's different than the kinds of biometrics we've used before. When you look at someone and you know they've given their fingerprint for various identification purposes or maybe to unlock their phone, you can't look at them and determine that a fingerprint that you know about matches up with that person, but you can look at them and know that a face does. So it does change things in rather interesting ways. Scarlett, Privacy International does a lot of work on biometrics, so I'm wondering what your organization's take is on the new Face ID in the iPhone X.
So I think to begin, what you're seeing is, you know, in general, I think the public is inured to trading away sort of bits and pieces of our identity expressed as data. And one thing to note is that biometric data is particularly sensitive data. I think the other thing to note is that there are a lot of narratives about the accuracy of biometric data. And I think that we should maybe interrogate those narratives a bit, because there are studies that have shown, for example, that rates of accuracy can really vary depending on, you know, the quality of the data that's collected. And also, for example, I think it was so Georgetown released this report, I think it was last year, called the Perpetual Lineup, that was about law enforcement use of facial recognition technology around the country. And they noted that actually for certain races, for example, facial recognition, the current state of facial recognition software is not necessarily as accurate as for other races. So to the extent that you're using facial recognition technology, it can maybe disproportionately affect certain groups in terms of how accurate the data can be. I think from our perspective, you know, our surveillance work focuses a lot on state surveillance. So we're primarily concerned with how states adopt and implement novel forms of technology. But I think, you know, there is this kind of private sector aspect to that, because often it's companies that are developing this technology, and that market will grow. And there will also be companies that will sell this technology to governments. And then the other kind of corporate government nexus is that when companies start to collect this data, it can create a honeypot for third parties, including governments. I think the other concerns are when facial recognition data is used, for example, to make inferences about people and then to make what we would describe as consequential decisions. We would consider consequential decisions to be those that might affect a person's right. You know, and that can include a broad range of rights. And this applies in both the private and the government context. So in the private context, you might imagine, for example, companies that use facial recognition or other biometric data to make decisions about a person's health or suitability for a job or suitability for a place at a public university, maybe. These are just random examples that are off the top of my head. But mm-hmm. on the state side of things, you could also imagine facial recognition technology being used in ways that could also infringe a broad range of rights. So again, referencing that Georgetown report, I believe there was discussion there about how there was no explicit prohibition among most law enforcement agencies for using facial recognition technology to police protests. So to use that technology to identify people attending protests. And obviously that could have a chilling effect on both the right to freedom of expression and freedom of assembly.
Right. And that Georgetown study that you mentioned also included that nearly half of all Americans are in a law enforcement database that includes facial recognition.
And that was in 2016, by the way. That was in 2016, the year that the FBI thumbprint database had been expanded to the next gen database to include biometrics and DNA and everything. So there's no indication that that number has decreased since 2016.
Right. Right. And yeah. And one thing that has changed since the last time we pondered the iPhone 10 and its Face ID here on This Week in Law is just yesterday we learned via Reuters, which got its hands on a developer agreement between Apple and a third party developer, that despite what Apple has been very discursive about since it announced the iPhone 10, and despite its responses to Senator Al Franken's concerns that he wrote an open letter to the company and said, hey, you know, you're going to have all this 3D facial identification information on people. Please assure us that that is only going to reside, you know, please tell us what you're going to do with that data and make sure that we feel good about that. And the response has been, well, it's only going to reside in a secure vault on the device itself. It's not even going to be on our servers. But it appears now, based on the terms of this contract that Reuters has seen, that Apple will allow developers to take certain facial data off the phone as long as they agree then to seek customer permission and not sell the data to third parties. So that seems problematic on any number of fronts. Just ticking down the list, the granting of customer permission, we talk a lot on the show about how things aren't read, people don't pay attention to the rights that they're giving away. Is this going to be buried in 20 pages of legalese? Is it going to be something meaningful as far as getting customer consent? That remains to be seen. And also this contractual stricture on Apple's developers, oh, please get consent and don't ever sell it. You know, that's a contractual stricture. So contracts are breached all the time. And there are some 2 million apps in the App Store. So it's going to be, I think, very difficult once this genie is out of the bottle and this facial data that was supposed to live only in the secure vault on your phone is in the hands of various and sundry third-party developers, for it not to wind up in law enforcement databases and not to wind up in marketing databases for people who want to market to you based on what your various facial expressions might be. It seems to be a big problem that just was made public yesterday. And as far as I know, Apple has not yet responded to what Reuters unearthed. So
it's important that I think, you know, even if Apple is not doing this, I mean, we haven't seen the contract. This is just what Reuters has reported. But even if Apple is not doing this, there's nothing to stop any of the other companies that are building facial recognition tech into their phones from having exactly this sort of language. So if we're not seeing it now with Apple, which, you know, again, I think that Apple has been as privacy focused as we could have hoped and as proactive as we could have hoped on building this correctly from the ground up. I personally am at least far less confident that, you know, Huawei or any of the other numerous cheaper Android phones are going to be following the same best practices.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. What do you think, Scarlett, of the fact that even though Apple doesn't want to do bad things with your data, it is going to allow third parties, apparently, if this Reuters report is accurate, to have access to that data?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with everything you and Emery have said. You know, I mentioned how this data can create sort of a honeypot for third parties. And I was thinking mm-hmm. there more about perhaps unauthorized access. But what mm-hmm. you're seeing here is a kind of proliferation creep, which you see in a lot of instances where there's this understanding that data might be confined to one place for one purpose, but it ends up in the hands of multiple parties. I guess I'm also curious. I mean, I don't know what the sort of protected status is of biometric data, like of your face under US law. But I think there's this question about if you're giving away that data to third party developers, if that means then that you could have the state just I don't know if it engages the third party doctrine at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I might be completely off base here, but with, you know, Carpenter v. U.S. going up to the Supreme Court, I think there is this question about all the things that we willingly give away, and I say willingly sort of sarcastically, but what mm-hmm. users consent to in terms of giving away to third-party companies, how that actually affects also the way that we protect that information vis-a-vis the state.
Right, and I'm a little miffed at Apple, I guess, that in the course of, again, if this Reuters report turns out to be accurate, that in the course of addressing people's concerns over Face ID and privacy, they have not been forthcoming about this and saying, secured vault on your phone and, oh, by the way, third parties too. That hasn't come up at all. Yeah. That seems a little sketchy to me. Mm-hmm. Mike, what are your mm-hmm. thoughts?
Yeah, so I was just curious if anybody was familiar with any judicial decisions involving use of facial recognition in the context of fingering or pinpointing a particular criminal defendant. I'm not aware of any. It seems as though that issue is bound to come up at some point. And at that point, this Georgetown study or one of these other studies that shows the error rate associated with facial recognition seems like that could come into play to challenge this technology as a valid basis for using in a criminal defendant's trial.
Yeah, I can't think of a specific instance where that's happened. I know that we've seen at least reports that, you know, local highway police have been, you know, taking photographs or using, you know, applications that do some sort of biometric lookup. So I don't know particularly, but certainly it's going to be an issue if it isn't already.
Right.
Absolutely.
One of the things this Daily Mail piece does is talk about the fact that privacy advocates like Privacy International and others are trying to stave off the time when a law enforcement officer wandering the streets can have, you know, some sort of Google Glass overview or some sort of way of scanning the faces of people around them and knowing information about them just moving through crowds from face recognition databases. But I think that staving that off is about the best we can do. I think we are definitely headed toward it. Don't you, Scarlett?
Yeah, so one of the things that the Georgetown report found so troubling was just the lack of regulation around the use of the technology. And I also thought I think they draw a kind of interesting distinction in the ways in which you might use this technology in permissible and impermissible ways. But because of the lack of regulation, those lines haven't been drawn clearly enough for example, law enforcement agencies. One permissible ways would include kind of targeted uses of facial recognition technology. So as a way of verifying, for example, the identity of a specific person. But ways in which we might consider impermissible, for example, would be if you have facial recognition software running over kind of a real-time surveillance camera. So it's basically scanning the faces of everybody walking in front of that camera.
We've seen that in China, right? I think aptly named, terrifyingly named Skynet system of CCTV cameras. They've just rolled out, or they are in the process of rolling out AI tools to improve the act of real-time live facial recognition through their CCTV cameras. I mean, that's as Big Brother as it gets, and it's real life right now today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's not that hard to imagine similar uses of that technology if it continues unregulated in for example in the US context as well.
Scarlett, I actually just had a quick thought. I know that the UK is notorious as the hub of CCTV cameras. Is China surpassing the UK as far as like density of cameras, or is the UK, do you know, still like the most densely surveilled city in the world?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I mean, you know, there's this popular idea. I mean, I think that London, for example, is one of the most like densely networked CCTV camera city in the world. But but I don't know right now, for example, if there are Chinese cities like Beijing or Shanghai that have surpassed London in their sort of blanketing.
It's just 2017, y'all. This is crazy.
Yeah, it is. And for folks who want to dig deeper on these privacy issues related to the iPhone 10 and Face ID and where this, what world this brings us to in 2017, I really encourage you to check out some of the links in our discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 406 this go round. Christina Bonington, writing at Slate, has a really good piece as well as this Daily Mail piece we've been talking about, pointing out how putting information on your phone in the hands of third parties is something that has gotten Apple in trouble before, brings up how Path was uploading contacts from people's address books without their permission. Without Apple's permission. Then Uber as well ran afoul and almost got kicked out of the App Store for violating Apple's privacy rules. So
there was a great article last week as well about how developers can basically, as long as the developer has a notification pop-up that allows the user to affirmatively give permission, then their application, as long as it's approved by Apple into the App Store, is allowed to access any of the sensors that you've given it permission to. And there was a really good article about an attack, I guess, or an exploit where developers could basically just put a message up, or you know, a notification pop up that lies to the user about what sensor that's having access to. And so I can imagine that would be especially problematic when we're talking about the extremely complex facial scanners in the iPhone X.
Right. And you're sort of pointing out the problem of just having way too many apps to try and police. If somebody finds a technical workaround and gets their way into the App Store, despite Apple's best intentions, you could still find yourself getting your data taken away from you in ways you did not anticipate. What was your quote at the beginning of the show, Scarlett, that technology is above and beside and beyond the law, something like that?
Yeah, exactly. That's something our technologists like to say to demonstrate that lawyers are useless and we should listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing that play out here. Mike, do you have any further thoughts?
No further thoughts from snowy Seattle here.
Yes, it's very white outside your window. Yes. Now you have a definite blizzard going on.
It's snowing very hard at this point, so
Oh, that's so cool. Well, again, I think it's cool. You have to go home in it.
I'm going to go make a snowman after the show here.
Ugh. Yeah, this is totally off topic, but I'm just curious, since you don't live in the mountains, but live in a city that can get snow, do people have four-wheel drive? Do people have chains? How do people get around?
Well, you know, Seattle's on a series of hills, and so it can be very interesting driving when it's snowy here, because we don't typically get a lot of snow, and there's probably one or two snowplows, I think, in the whole county. So, I think there's a few more than that, but it doesn't seem like it.
All right, well, be safe on your way home today.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's move on. We've been, you know, hopefully scaring you to death here in the wake of Halloween. Let's move on to an equally scary topic that Scarlett is also working on, related to mass surveillance, but beyond just sort of passively collecting data on people. Let's talk about governments deciding to take control of your device and surveil you that way. So another Privacy International challenge that you're working on, Scarlett, has to do with government hacking. Tell us about that.
So this also goes back to the Snowden disclosures, which revealed that in the UK, the government communications headquarters, which is like the British equivalent to the NSA, had been engaging in really intrusive hacking techniques, both domestically and abroad. And we brought a case challenging these practices actually with seven internet and communication service providers, two of which are based in the US actually, again, on similar grounds that it violated the right to privacy and freedom of expression.
Tell us exactly what you're challenging, what sort of hacking was going on.
So the capabilities that were described were really broad ranging. It ranged from remote access to mobile phones, where they claimed the capability to access all the data on the device, to remotely turn on the microphone and the webcam, also to erase any trace of the intrusion. Then there were also reports about attacks that weren't directed just at the device level, but at almost a kind of more network level. The Snowden disclosures revealed that they had successfully attacked and accessed information stored by Belgacom, which is the Belgian telecommunications provider, and that they also had successfully hacked Gemalto, which is a company that produces SIM cards. It's based in Europe.
So you're saying that not only are individuals and their devices hacked and hackable, but that rather than just doing a Prism-like cooperation with repositories of data like telecom companies, the governments, per the Snowden disclosures, have the ability seem to be engaging in actual breaking into those databases without the consent of the entity itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the Snowden disclosures also reveal that the NSA engages in these capabilities, sometimes in partnership with GCHQ. As part of their kind of closely integrated relationship, they've pledged to not only exchange raw signals intelligence, but also the methods and techniques by which they collect intelligence. And so there were reports, for example, of shared malware libraries between the two agencies.
Wow. Okay, so you're challenging this. Tell us about the status of that.
So we brought it before the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, as we've already described, basically a rubber stamping court, and we actually lost. And we actually split the case into two component appeals. So one appeal has gone up to the European Court of Human Rights, and that appeal focuses on GCHQ's foreign-facing hacking powers. And we brought that case together with the internet and communication service providers that we initially brought the case with at the UK level. we have a separate challenge that's a kind of collateral challenge within the UK legal system that focuses on a particular issue that emerged during the initial proceedings. During those proceedings, the government avowed for the first time, admitted that they do hack, and provided some disclosure about the scope of those capabilities. And in the disclosures, they admitted that they were seeking basically general warrants to hack domestically. So warrants that don't target a specified individual or property or device, but warrants based on classes of unidentified persons or places or systems. And we posited a range of hypotheticals to kind of suss out the scope of these warrants. And we posited one hypothetical that under the power they were asserting, they could use a single warrant to hack all mobile phones in a British city. And the government actually admitted that they did have that power. The reason why we brought a collateral challenge on this one issue is that it's more of an English common law issue, because there have been sort of 250 years of English common law that have said that a warrant needs to be targeted. It's kind of like, you know, the Fourth Amendment, essentially, although it's written into the common law and not a constitution, because there's no constitution here. And so it's an issue that engages more sort of domestic interpretations of the common law. And so we've brought what's called a collateral challenge. It's called a judicial review process, where you can basically collaterally challenge a lower tribunal's decision as being unlawful. And we have basically styled our appeal against this one issue as a kind of collateral challenge, because it engages issues of domestic UK law.
Got it. So again, I'm guessing that your outlook on this is probably not terribly bright, but that it's worth bringing the issue to the fore. Does that pretty much?
I think the courts of general jurisdiction are not like the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. In some ways, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, if I was to draw a really rough analogy, we might consider it sort of like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, where a lot of the information that's provided to it is secret, and it's not considered a venue that is really kind of neutral to victims of surveillance. We do think that the general courts may be more sympathetic to our claim, especially because the argument that the government is asserting really runs against such a long strain of the common law.
Got it. Wow. Emery, anything you want to determine here?
Well, I know that you guys are doing a crowdfunding campaign to help you with this. Do you want to, I guess, plug that and give any information to our listeners about why, one, we need a crowdfunding campaign to move forward with this, and then two, how they can help if they're interested?
Absolutely. So the Investigatory Powers Tribunal actually doesn't have a costs regime attached to it. So you can go in and make a claim, and if you lose, you don't have to pay the government's costs. But in the regular courts, unlike in the U.S., when you bring a civil liberties or human rights claim, if you lose, you're on the hook for the government's costs, which can run sometimes into the six figures. And it obviously has a huge chilling effect on the ability to bring the kind of test litigation that organizations like the ACLU or the EFF bring in the U.S. We were able in this instance to get what's called a protective costs order, and that caps the amount that we will have to pay the government if we are to lose. But currently, that cap is at £25,000, which is quite a large sum of money for an organization of our size. We're quite small. You know, we have limited resources. And so we're crowdfunding and trying to raise the amount of the costs cap.
Seems like a worthy effort. Mike, any questions?
So, Scarlett, you had mentioned with respect to both of these cases that it's all based on the Snowden disclosures. Is your organization, are you working with Snowden directly? Is he a witness? Do you collaborate with him? If you can share that with us.
No, we don't. I mean, we basically rely on the information as it's currently available in the public domain. And we don't, he hasn't been a witness. We've had witnesses in our cases, but primarily experts in computer security or in, for example, networking and that sort of thing. But there's, yeah, no direct involvement of Snowden in any of our cases.
And are both of these cases, are they typical trials where you would call witnesses and examine them, cross-examination, you know, get documents into evidence and those sorts of things?
No, the way that the Investigatory Powers Tribunal works, there's no – you provide witness statements, but there's no in-person witness examination and cross-examination. And the witness statements, then the sort of the facts as contained in those statements get disputed during the oral hearings. But the witnesses themselves don't come in and kind of get interrogated.
Got it.
And I know you gave some procedural history of the case so far, but in case I missed it, how long has this case been going on? And yeah, how long has it – when did you first bring it in? What sort of timeline can we look for?
So we brought our initial claim in, I think it was May 2014. And then we had a final judgment from the Investigatory Powers Tribunal in, I believe it was February of last year. So February 2016. And then shortly thereafter, we filed both our application up to the European Court of Human Rights and our application before what's called the High Court. So it would be sort of like the district level court in the UK. And we lost at the district level court, and we're actually up now currently before the Court of Appeal, and we just had an oral hearing before the Court of Appeal, and we're awaiting judgment from the Court of Appeal.
And so to give a little bit more background to our listeners and viewers, is this claim specific to hacking webcams, or is it more broadly about hacking all of our devices, or is there a particular subset of that you guys are targeting?
It's not specific to webcams. It's basically a direct challenge to the broad range of hacking techniques that the government engages in. But the collateral challenge that I described using this judicial review process is particularly aimed at the general warrants that the government is seeking to hack domestically.
So I know that in the when they ruled against you, they said I need to pull up the exact quote, but they said something like the warrants didn't need to be defined with like particularity. I think it effectively to that effect, where the warrants don't need to list the individual. Is there any other justification about how that's different from a general warrant, or are they just saying what is the state's argument in that case?
They're just calling them thematic warrants, and they claim that's. I mean, they call them thematic warrants, I guess, to differentiate between the term general warrants. But then when you hear them describe what a thematic warrant is, it is a general warrant.
Right. And
what's kind of hilarious is that the UK surveillance framework, as I described this legislation that just passed, it actually articulates targeted and bulk powers. But the thematic warrants are contained in the targeted powers. So it's really hard to understand how the targeted powers are actually different from the bulk powers. And when this piece of legislation was going through Parliament, there was actually kind of a criticism levied by, I think it was the intelligence Security Committee noted that they were sort of having trouble understanding the boundaries between thematic warrants and bulk powers.
So just to one final note to this, maybe drive home why this is important to our listeners. The example that rings out in my mind, of course, is the notorious GCHQ using or hacking Yahoo users' webcams and turning out with at the end of the day, finding that they had tons and tons of nude images, and that was why they had to sunset the program. Is there any other, egregious examples that you'd like to highlight to illustrate how maybe to our listeners that don't understand why would I not want our government to be able to hack criminals' devices? Maybe want to rethink their position.
Well, from our perspective, like hacking is really it's unlike any other existing form of surveillance technique, because it's really about interfering with systems. And so from a privacy perspective, the intrusion is actually much broader than, for example, if you're capturing communications or data that's transiting over a fiber optic cable. You know, if you're able to access a person's device and you think about all the information that we contain on our devices, it's just a much broader range of information that you may never have even intended to disseminate to another person. And once you have access to the device, it also means that you might have access to information that you store in the cloud. It also permits novel forms of real-time surveillance by turning on, for example, the camera or the microphone remotely, or tracking sort of the GPS location of the individual as they're carrying their device around. There's also this danger of the fact that you can actually manipulate data on the device. And it raises a lot of questions about the integrity of the evidence you're collecting and how you're actually able to verify that evidence. And then the other issue is not a privacy issue, but it's really a security issue, because when governments engage in hacking techniques, sometimes they, you know, for example, exploit vulnerabilities on systems that millions of people may use. And there's kind of the narrower problem of, okay, so maybe the government has actually a specific set of targets in mind, but there is always, I think, this danger with certain techniques that the exploit can proliferate to other devices unintentionally. But
right.
I think
we've
more
seen
broadly,
ransomware attacks that have used known exploits leaked from NSA documents to attack millions.
Absolutely.
And that this is a reality.
Yeah. And then I think more broadly, there's just this inherent tension, which is that if governments are seeking to use vulnerabilities in order to facilitate surveillance, then they're naturally not going to be inclined to engage in a kind of responsible disclosure process. And so there's a real tension there between kind of stockpiling or holding on to vulnerabilities to exploit for surveillance purposes and actually working to secure our devices, working with vendors and manufacturers to secure our devices.
Yeah, Beatmaster has a great point in the chat. Oh, sorry, Denise.
No, go ahead. Says, Beatmaster first.
But Beatmaster's brought up a good point that says, you know, that sounds like evidence tampering. And, you know, I the idea of governments hacking also brings up the whole chain of custody for evidence and how
absolutely
how can we trust that the evidence wasn't tampered with after the fact? I mean, this is
absolutely
right. It also, the security point just puts governments and their citizens in such an adversarial situation where the government specifically knows that particular individuals' systems are compromised and is exploiting that rather than trying to do anything ethical or helpful about it.
I mean, at the very least, our point is that governments really aren't engaging in the type of balancing exercise that they need to be engaging in. If they're going to exploit a vulnerability in a system that millions of people use, then that needs to be part of the process of determining whether or not it's actually worth holding on to the vulnerability in order to exploit it for some potentially limited surveillance objective.
Right. Can I just go back to one thing you mentioned a moment ago, Emery?
Yeah.
Is there, how did I miss this? The GCHQ has admitted to hacking Yahoo users' webcams, if I'm hearing you correctly, and also admitted to stopping that program because too many people were wandering around in the buff?
Yeah, no, it was, I'm trying to pull it up, but yeah.
It's called Optic Nerve.
Thank you. Yeah, with their program Optic Nerve, they were hacking Yahoo accounts, turning on webcams remotely, scooping up a lot of data. And I think predictably they found that a fair portion of that data was nudes. And they also found that, just like we've seen in America, in our intelligence organizations, when, you know, contractors and independent people have access to nude images, they get traded along. And, you know, that sort of information is abused. So, yeah, one of the reasons for rolling back Optic Nerve was that the intelligence operatives, what is the right word? The intelligence
agents,
I guess, yeah, were getting too much nudes and trading them. So
one thing I should note based on the image that you have up is that actually this was a joint GCHQ NSA operation.
Oh, great.
I'm not sure if it was a hacking operation so much as they were managed to somehow intercept the webcam images. I'm not sure about the technical details, but regardless, it also demonstrates how closely integrated the operations of both agencies are.
Wow. Okay, I wrote down
and the
a
human
second
availability and all. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's really important. You know, I mean, not to bring up unrelated news, but of course, yesterday there was the bombshell that Donald Trump's Twitter account was disabled by a disgruntled Twitter employee on his last days, and was disabled for like 11 minutes. But, you know, it's important to keep in mind, I think, when everyone's talking about these issues, that at the end of the day, that somewhere along the line, there is a human being sitting behind a computer. Whether it's a terminal or a GUI with, you know, seeing that information pass in front of their eyes. And, you know, I don't trust anyone with that kind of information.
Well, you're not alone. All of this discussion as we were ramping up for the show today made me remember that there was a photograph taken of Mark Zuckerberg last year in June of 2016. Where he was helping celebrate Instagram reaching 500 million monthly users, and he's holding up like an Instagram frame around himself in front of his own desk. And folks, at least one person, Chris Olson on Twitter, took a look at this photo and zoomed in on the computer and noticed three things. The camera was covered with tape, the mic jack was covered with tape, and his email client was Thunderbird. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is concerned about these things. Over at The Verge, where they wrote this up, they pointed out that earlier that year, the FBI, the then FBI director, James Comey, said he had placed tape on his laptop after he saw, quote unquote, somebody smarter with a taped up camera. So, you know, I mean, it may sound paranoid, but I think delving into what we know from Scarlett and her organization's work, it's not that paranoid. So don't laugh at my sticky over my camera, please. What else? Oh, I wrote down a second MCLE passphrase for our show. It's going to be thematic warrants. So jot that down for yourself. What do you think, Mike?
Phrase.
Are you all taped up over there, or is the snow just making it impossible to see through your camera? Yeah, there we go.
Right. Now, you know, good enough for Mark Zuckerberg and Jim Comey. It's good enough for me. Good idea. Tape up, everybody.
No, I keep a sticky note up near my camera on my computer because that way I can put it on and off and stuff for doing the show and doing Skype. And it's got a big smiley face on it so that I remind myself to look up at the camera and smile when I'm doing the show. And I guess it's smiling when it's covering the camera too for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I unplug this one, but...
You just unplugged your whole system. Yeah, you're...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that would do it. All right. Where are we going next? Well, since we're talking about surveillance, let's move on and discuss the fact that Section 702 is due to sunset at the end of this year unless legislators do something about it, and they're trying to do something about it. So this is the provision that gave rise to everything that we've been discussing on the show today, the authorities, at least on the NSA's part, to be able to do the things that Edward Snowden revealed that it was doing. And it is due to actually go away unless Congress gets involved and enacts some sort of amendment or reform or replacement provision. Emery, can you tell us what's going on with this here?
Yeah, so we talked about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act earlier. Essentially, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is the 1978 act that provided the statutory authority for foreign intelligence surveillance. And in 2008, it was amended with Section 702, which outlines how the government is able to intercept communications with foreign intelligence or foreign individuals, I guess. It's not supposed to technically cover or allow or permit domestic surveillance, but of course, since we learned in 2013, thanks to Ed Snowden, It does, in fact, get used to scoop up a fair amount of domestic American citizen information. And so Section 702 was always supposed to or always set to expire in at the end of 2017. So it is up for review. And there are a couple bills that are being pushed to either amend or completely cleanly reauthorize it. And it's something to follow. Obviously, the EFF has come out in favor of one of the bills backed by Senator Ryden and Rand Paul. The only Republican who has authorized this kind of reform. But there are a couple of sort of reforms on the table to try to maybe close some of the loopholes that have allowed American citizens to be scooped up in this kind of surveillance and to provide some more transparency into the entire process. And so one of the ways that I don't want to just go through line by line every item of what the proposal changes. The bill that the EFF supports is the USA Rights Act. I was talking with Denise before the show. I can never keep track of the trend of sort of Orwellian doublespeak bill names. So I know that one of them may be called like the USA Freedom Act or something similarly intellectually dishonest. But essentially, the USA Rights Act closes a couple of loopholes, including one of the ways that Americans have been scooped up in 702 searches is that 702 authorizes surveillance of foreign individuals, but or foreign communications with foreign individuals. And that means that if you are an American citizen and you communicate with someone not an American citizen, then, well, your information gets scooped up in that. There's also something called about searches that NSA uses where it's not searching communications that are to or from a non-American, but they're searching communications that include about a foreign person. So it could be me talking to you, Denise, about third party X that may be a person of interest. And suddenly our communications are scooped up into the system as well. I mean, I don't really know what else to add to that.
Right.
Privacy International, you were speaking earlier, Scarlett, before the show that PI, because this issue is being sort of handled by a lot of American organizations, PI is sort of dealing with it from afar. But call your senators, ask them to support the USA Rights Act. And, you know, kudos to the sort of bipartisan commission of politicians. If you include Rand Paul in that group, for trying to actually have a discussion about how the government uses this act. So
right. With the swirl of other headlines and news, it's easy for this to kind of get swept up and ignored, but it is an important thing. And you know, especially now that the tax reform bill is bill or bills are taking a lot of the air in the room. You might not know that this is also going on, and it will go on before the end of the year because this law is due to expire on its own terms, and no one's going to let it expire. They're going to do something to replace it. So if you want to have some say in what is done and how surveillance works, this would be a good time to do some research and get in touch with your representatives. Emery, I'm wondering, because I haven't seen, and I'm wondering if you have, the administration itself weigh in on the renewal or what the renewal of 702 should look like. Because way back earlier this year, when President Trump was tweeting, I've been wiretapped by the Obama administration. This is what he was talking about. And precisely
what you mentioned a moment ago. Donald Trump may be inconsistent with his opinions and what he says on Twitter. I'm just utterly shocked. I think that we should stop the presses and, you know, just hold on to our horses. Right. No, I mean, yeah.
There is some deep irony here that the president was concerned about people around him having been swept up, as you were mentioning a moment ago, in searches related.
And Obama, of course, campaigned on, you know, being the most transparent administration in history. And yet, just like Obama did, Donald Trump is going to be asking for a clean reauthorization because they are the state and they have all the power. And why would they not want it? Right. So That's a lesson for you folks. Don't let people have these powers, because inevitably they're going to be used by someone bad.
Right. And I don't know. I'm going to definitely keep an eye out to see if the administration does have something to say about Section 702, because I think it's interesting.
I mean, they've just asked for a clean reauthorization.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
no commentary involved. All right. Mike, any thoughts?
No, nothing further from here.
All right. I think we can go ahead and begin to conclude the show. We have a number of great resources of the week and tips of the week for you. And of course, just because, you know what? Nah, we'll save that for next time. We're running out of time. We'll talk about spooky robot AI. I don't know. Emery, you might not be on next time. Should we talk about spooky robot AI before we wrap the show?
Come on, it's still topical, right? This is Halloween
week.
Yeah,
we probably have time. All right, then roll the robots, Victor, please. Thank you. Over at MIT, they have developed an artificially intelligent neural networky kind of tool that lives on Twitter. She is called Shelly. Her handle is Shelly_AI. Shelly as in the author, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, English writer Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. And it is an AI system that helps craft, contributes to, and gets feedback from people on Twitter as well on crafting scary tales just in time for Halloween last weekend. It seems like a cool new use of AI. It is both a neural network and online learning algorithm that learns from the crowd's feedback over time, according to the lead researcher at MIT Media Lab's Scalable Cooperation Group. His name is Pinar Yonardag, if I'm saying that properly. So, Emery, it's not cranking out names of law firms, but it's kind of cool, right?
Oh, I just think it's really cool. I mean, it's machine learning, and it also learns from crowd feedback. And if I can just read one paragraph, a few sentences of one of the stories that it generated, I think it'd be appropriate given the Halloween season. But this is the story, Baby. When I heard the phone ring, I ran to the stairs. As I was running down the stairs, I started to hear crying. I shone my phone around the corner of the staircase and saw the crying baby getting closer. I crawled over to it and kicked it as hard as I could. The crying from the stairs turned into a soft, metallic sound. I mean, that's pretty good, right?
Baby's right. Not a baby.
Other than kicking the baby part, you know, that's
clearly they suspected the baby. Was something metallic.
It brings up all the interesting copyright questions we've talked about before.
Yes.
You know, this is a far cry from a tweet. This is, you know, a fully composed story. So I think it's hard to argue that this doesn't rise to the level of copyrightability if a human being wrote it. So it's, you know.
I was with a bunch of law professors last night, some of whom are ending their term right around Thanksgiving and giving finals right around now. So pay heed to Shelly_AI could be great fodder for an exam question, living as it does on Twitter and being composed, at least in part, by a non-human creative force. So quite fascinating and, as you say, topical for this season, Emery. Let's move on. Before we move on, Mike, any thoughts?
On Shelly?
Yes.
I thought it was really clever. I followed Shelly, and I'm going to be watching closely to see what happens.
Yep. I can't think of any real privacy ramifications here, Scarlett, but maybe you can. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
I mean, there's always a great AI page that PI published, right, about the risks of AI generally in privacy. I think that we included in the show notes, but we didn't get to discuss it today. But there's always some exciting, interesting privacy implications with those.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, our general position as a privacy organization, everyone thinks that we see privacy implications everywhere and we oppose. We're not Luddites, so, you know, we don't oppose AI per se. But most of our work on AI is focused on particularly the use of AI where there are privacy implications. And primarily those kind of fall into three buckets. So the first would be where AI is used to identify and track individuals. The other is where it's used to make inferences about individuals. And the third is where it's used to make what we call consequential decisions. So decisions that would affect a person's right, for example, to be free from discrimination and that sort of thing. So so the thing with AI is that it encompasses so much and it's used in so many domains and it has so many applications. So what we try to do is focus our work on the domains in which those types of rights implications might emerge. But I think Shelley seems okay.
For those who want to be scared. And interesting too that it's was trained on a subreddit that the piece we have in our discussion points calls famous, but I hadn't heard of before, that is all about just scaring the pants off you. So let's see if I can find exactly.
Creepypasta or something?
Creepypasta?
I
don't know.
Might be one of those.
Anyway, find our discussion points. It's called No Sleep, r/No Sleep subreddit, logically enough. All right, so let us get to our tips and resources and things. Our resource of the week is something we were going to talk about. First of all, our resource of the week is definitely Privacy International and all of the materials there and the projects they're involved in. Hopefully you've learned enough during the show today to go check it out for yourself and learn more about what Scarlett and her colleagues are up to. But we do have another resource to clue you into. It's something we were going to get to last week, didn't have the time, and we don't have the time to go through it in detail this week either, but it's such a nice long read that I encourage you, if you're curious, to go read it yourself. It's a piece called The Judge's Code by Sarah Jong. It's published at The Verge, and it's all about Judge William H. Alsup, who was the judge in the Oracle versus Google litigation and is now the judge in the Waymo Uber litigation on theft of trade secrets. And he's just this deeply, deeply geeky guy. He's in, you remember during the Oracle versus Google case, he took it upon himself to chime in and talk about the fact that he taught himself a bit of Java during the trial to be able to understand it better. And he could chime in and intelligently critique what the lawyers were telling him about Java during that case, which blew a lot of people away. And he's quick now to say, no, I don't actually code in Java. I just, you know, taught myself a little bit about it for the case. But he does code in things like BASIC and has written some programs, bridge program for his wife and various other things. Sarah asked him if he was going to put the things that he'd written up on GitHub, and he's sort of glazed over. He didn't know what GitHub was yet, but he was born in, I believe, 1945, according to this article. So he can perhaps be forgiven for that. As I think Sarah at one point calls him a geek from another era. He was very into ham radio as he was growing up. And he's a rarity among the judicial branch in the United States as someone who has an affinity for technology and a deep understanding in his own way of tech issues. So it's great that he's been involved in some very high profile tech cases and hopefully will continue to be. Mike, any thoughts?
He's a super interesting judge, and I commend the article that Sarah wrote. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Emery, any thoughts?
Much of the same. You know, it's always great to know that there are judges, even those of the ham radio generation that have taken it upon themselves to actually internalize and learn the underlying technologies they're ruling on.
Right. It's funny. Sarah concludes the article by a quote from him saying, "In my day, a geek was not something you wanted to be." I think we all now proudly in our own way embrace that title. Let's see. Tips of the week. Several of those too. In our ongoing series of things robots can do and or are these days, robots soon can be super camouflaged. This is just something I stumbled across that I thought was very interesting. Synthetic octopus skin is being developed to clad robots and certain robots, obviously not all of them, and make it so that they can camouflage themselves in the way that octopi can. They can add texture to their skin and change colors and morph in with their surroundings in the way that octopi can. So I think this, or would it be octopuses? I'm really not sure. Anyway, interesting little detail. So in addition to doing dental surgery and being molecular, perhaps you will bump into a robot that is virtually invisible by virtue of its super camouflage. Another interesting development from this week is the fact that it became clear, based on a journalist's document getting frozen as she was working in Google Docs, that Google Docs is scanning the data that you're writing into your Google Doc for things that are flags of abuse. And so certainly I think people are aware, or maybe they just don't give it a second thought, that when you're using Gmail and Google Docs and other third-party cloud items, that the provider has access to what you're putting in there. But here it became apparent because this journalist's document was noted by an automated system that was analyzing her document and had some sort of indicator of abuse, whatever that is. So there was some sort of code push that made this more apparent than it had been. And it brought to mind that Google was fast to say that, no, it's only our automated systems. We're not having humans examining your document and flagging them. But there is some sort of review process that's going on when you're using Google Docs. I'm sure that's something that Privacy International knew about already, Scarlett, but probably knows that most people who use Google Docs wouldn't pay attention to it, right?
Yes. I mean, it goes back to the point that you made earlier in the show about what does consent really mean? Mm-hmm. Do individuals using Google Docs, are they actually aware that that the company is scanning all of the documents that they store in the cloud, and then actually making inferences based on the content of the stuff that you're writing, and then flagging it up? I mean, from my perspective, it's no less creepy if it was a human doing it as opposed to a machine.
Yeah. And the way that Google does disclose this is it's buried in its terms of service, which explain that its automated systems analyze this information and it is sent and received. So it's not giving you any specific flags that, oh, and if you do something that violates whatever we think is abuse, we might be freezing your documents. So
if you read that far into the TOU or in the privacy policy, right, you might get that one line of generic non-information.
Yeah. Or read it at all. I mean, then I'm guessing you put this in, Emery, and I had tweeted this as well, so I'm glad we get to mention it on the show too, that this weekend there is a celebration of the life and work of Aaron Swartz at the Internet Archive. So if you want to participate in that, head on over to either EFF or archive.org, and you'll learn more if you don't already know about Aaron Swartz and CFAA reform. Anything you want to add to this, Emery?
No, I mean, you know, Aaron Swartz is one of my personal heroes, and, you know, is a large part of why I'm here doing what I'm doing today. You know, I was trying to explain to the chat earlier, but, you know, what we lost with the loss of Aaron Swartz is just, it's hard to overstate. And he would have been 31 years old on November 8th. So it's, you know, just, I don't know, it really hit me in my gut to realize that I'm older now than Aaron Swartz ever got to be. And
wow.
Yeah, that's a gut
punch. Yeah, that hit me too.
It's really hard.
Yeah. All right. So we will leave you with our animal selfie of the week. I'm a fan of this one, particularly of the way that it was captured. Nothing was strapped to an animal. This is one of my favorite kinds of animal selfie. Mm-hmm. Here we've got a seagull who has taken a liking to a GoPro and decides to go do something with it. So we've got Seagull as cinematographer. There is nothing strapped unwillingly to the seagull. The seagull is quite a voluntary camera bird at this juncture. We not only get the seagull's view of the world.
We're also getting the video, shadow. We're getting the seagull's shadow there too.
Yeah, that's really cool. And we
the shadow is clearly intentional.
Yes, yes. And we get the seagull itself. So it's a true animal selfie. Just a great one. And then it's off. What I don't know is how, and they didn't comment when they posted this to YouTube, the owners of the GoPro, how on earth did they ever get their camera back? How are you tracking that seagull? Maybe the GoPro has some sort of tracking technology in it that I was unaware of. But they got it back and posted it to YouTube. So wonderful animal selfie for us this week. And it's been just an incredibly fascinating, somewhat sobering show with Scarlett Kim of Privacy International. We're so glad that you've been able to join us this week, Scarlett.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so grateful for the work that you and Privacy International do. It's hard work and necessary work, and we're very, very glad that you're doing it.
Thank you.
Emery Roan, wonderful to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Oh, thanks for having me. And Scarlett, I've got to echo Denise's comments. And thank you so much for joining us. It was a really great discussion. I'm glad we could have someone from PI on the show. I really like your organization. And by the way, listeners, they've got a really great logo. So.
Oh, they do. Yes. Highlight that, Victor, if you could. Scarlett was telling us before the show, sometimes it leads to a little bit of confusion, but they're privacy because they are crossed out. So that's how private they are. But sometimes it looks like you have people wonder if you're showing them a redacted document or something.
Yes. Well, I was mentioning before the show that we've actually had to take the crossing those sort of redactions off of our logo for our front door because the mailman got confused and thought that we had purposefully crossed out our logo to indicate that we were no longer located at our office space.
You're so private, you're not getting your mail. That's private.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mike Keyes, wonderful to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, safe travels home through the storm.
Oh, thank you. It was great to be with all of you. Have a great weekend.
It's Mike, been really at your cool. Window, you might just want to stay in the office. You know, it is looking grim out there.
The window has gotten whiter and whiter throughout the show.
There's a lot of snow coming down. So,
sorry. I'll go hang out at the beach for you. Describe what it's like.
Please do.
All right. Thank you all for joining us. It's been a really wonderful show. We're so glad that our audience has been able to go along on this ride with us this week. If you'd like to do that live, then you should join us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's going to change to 1900 UTC soon because we're about to change clocks back, fall back here in the U.S., But for now, it's 1800 UTC, and that's when we record the show live. So that's really fun. If you can join us, jump into our chat with us and play along. But don't worry about it. If you can, head on over to twit.tv/twill. And if you can't join us live, our entire archive of shows is there. This show will be there just as soon as we have the chance to edit it and post it. But we're going all the way back, throwing it way back to 2006 with episodes for this show. So if you want to watch 11 years worth of This Week in Law, they're all there for you. Well, some of them you can't watch. The early ones were audio, but they are all there. So you can go back and track through our coverage of the Snowden revelations and see that it's still making news 4 years later. And
that's right.
See what else
I was listening
was
to
going
that
on
before law school. Yep. That was brought back some memories of listening to Twill coverage while I was still post grad out of LSU in my tiny little garage apartment. That was good memories.
That's really, really cool. So have fun digging around in the archives if you'd like. Have fun seeing all the myriad ways that you can enjoy the show on your wrist device, on your phone device, on your wall-mounted large screen device, or on your desktop, tablet, whatever. We're available on all of those platforms. Subscribe and watch in whatever way makes sense for you. Let us know your feedback about the show, if you could, by leaving comments or reviews on whatever your platform of choice is. And please, please, as we wind down toward the end of the year here, we do this great tradition at twit.tv where we do best of shows during the holiday period. So if you have favorite moments from Twill in 2017, please submit your clips to twit.tv/best of. We'd love to hear what you have enjoyed the most from our programming this year. And all of your contributions will go into our clip show at the end of the year. So we really appreciate your help with that, too. With that, we'll go ahead and let you go and see you next week on This Week in Law. Till then, take care.